rocking and moaning, but when Alyssa asked for bandages, he stopped and looked directly at her for a second. Then he started rifling through the Abilify bags, tossing stuff everywhere as he searched for bandages. I was out of my mind with worry about Darla and Dad, but still fiercely proud of Ben in that moment. He found several rolls of gauze and passed them to Alyssa. She took the first roll and pressed the whole thing against the hole in Dad's belly. He moaned, but then placed his bloody hand over hers and pushed harder. "Gotta stop this bleeding," he gasped. Darla stirred. "Cold," she moaned. "Lieutenant," Ben yelled. He yelled it again before I figured out he was talking to me. "We have a tactical problem." He pointed towards the open back of the truck. Two pickup trucks were racing on the road behind us, gaining fast. Chapter 82. Both trucks had guns mounted on top of their cabs and a pair of guys standing in their beds. They were distant, but at the rate they were approaching, that wouldn't last. We were racing down a long, straight road lined with burned-out commercial buildings. "Can you go any faster?" I yelled. "It's floored," Mom yelled back. I heard a pop, pop, pop and the whang of a bullet ricocheting off metal as the gunner in the lead pickup started firing at us. The noise reminded me that we had a giant propane tank, a.k.a. bomb, sticking out the back of our truck. "Tie a bandage around Dad's stomach as tight as you can," I told Alyssa. I climbed up onto the propane tank. The first pickup was closer now, still firing steadily. Mom started weaving back and forth. The road was rough, bouncing us up and down. I didn't think the DWBs were likely to hit us until they got much closer. I lifted my rifle, lined it up on the lead pickup, and pulled the trigger. Click! I'd forgotten I was out of bullets. "I need a gun!" I yelled. Ben grabbed the assault rifle Dad had taken from Chad and tossed it to me. As soon as I got it seated against my shoulder and roughly in line with the pickups, I pulled the trigger. And nothing. The trigger wouldn't even operate. The safety! I'd forgotten the safety. I found it on the side of the gun and snicked it to full auto. The gun still wouldn't fire. "What's wrong with this piece of junk?" I yelled. "The magazine is not seated," Ben said. I lifted the gun and banged the base of the magazine against the propane tank. There was a dull clunk of metal on metal and a click as the magazine popped into place. As I aimed the gun again, the tank shivered under me and rang with a series of colossal blows. A row of holes appeared across the tank. Bullets ricocheted and rattled around inside it. I caught a whiff of propane and wondered briefly why I was still alive. Why hadn't the tank exploded, instantly converting us into ash and charred meat? "Don't shoot!" Ben screamed. "What?" "The muzzle flash of the AR-15 might ignite the aerated propane." "Stop! Now!" Dad yelled. "There!" He pointed left to a break in the embankment that allowed access to an alley. Mom slammed on the brakes, fishtailing to a stop. The trucks behind us raced closer, spraying bullets as they came. Mom dove out the driver's door, taking shelter in the alley. Alyssa followed, chivying Ben along with her. Darla crawled out on her own, and I helped Dad out of the passenger seat to the driver's side and tried to slide him out the driver's door. He stopped and sat down. "Come on!" I screamed. The trucks were almost on us. Dad screwed up his face in agony, planted his left foot on my chest, and shoved. I fell backwards onto the icy road. Gears ground as Dad shifted into reverse. "Goodbye," he said calmly. "Tell everyone I love them." The truck shot backward. "Dad!" I screamed. The propane truck slammed into the lead pickup. I rolled, scrambling towards the shelter of the alley. The explosion plucked me off the road and hurled me into the air. I flew for a few seconds before gravity caught me again and dashed me to earth. My back burned as if I'd been stung by 1,000 angry hornets. I smelled smoke, twisted, and realized my back was literally burning. I rolled on the icy road to put it out. The world around me had gone silent, and my ears had become hot knives stabbing into my brain. I touched an earlobe, and my hand came back covered with fresh blood. Dad. I looked back down the road. I had to squint against the inferno engulfing the conjoined wreckage of the trucks. The buildings on either side of the road had been flattened. One corner of a brick building was still standing, a rough masonry triangle that had sheltered Darla, Alyssa, Ben, and Mom. Ben's hands were clasped around his ears, and he was rocking again. Otherwise, they all looked dazed but unhurt. I stumbled to my feet and staggered toward the wreck. Dad, I breathed, releasing the word like a prayer or a kiss goodbye. A secondary detonation, the pickup's gas tank, perhaps, knocked me flat again. A few moments later, I felt hands under my arms, lifting me up. Alyssa was there, dusting the ash and grit from my singed clothing, checking me for punctures. She said something to me, and I shook my head, pointing to my ears. Darla was still sitting against the ruined brick wall, doubled over, maybe unconscious again. Mom stood nearby, staring at my father's fiercely burning pyre. Her eyes were vacant and dry, but her mouth was twisted into an expression of such horror that I had to look away. Ben's mouth was open now. Maybe he was moaning, but I couldn't hear anything. I put my arm across Alyssa's shoulders for support. Come on, I said, hobbling around the fire. Alyssa replied. I saw her lips move, but no sound reached my brain. Alyssa and I gave the wreck a wide berth. Even so, the heat was intense. The snow berms on both sides of the road had started to melt. Water trickled off them to join the ashy pool forming around the entire mess. About 50 feet farther on, I saw the rearmost pickup. It was slewed across the road, hood half buried in a snowbank. It was huge for a pickup, both a king cab and a dually. On the left side of the truck, the windows had blown inward, and its body was the color of charred steak. The door was open, and the driver had slumped out. The left side of his face was a horrifying patchwork of blackened skin and blood-covered glass fragments. A plume of steam rose from the back end of the truck. I thought about it for a moment and realized that the truck was idling, although I couldn't hear the engine. Despite the pounding it had taken, the truck still worked. I grabbed the least charred part of the driver's collar and dragged him the rest of the way out of the truck. He didn't move at all. Maybe he was dead, but I didn't care enough to spend the energy to check. It occurred to me that there had been two guys in the bed of the truck manning the roof-mounted gun. There was no sign of them now. The truck's airbags had deployed. I shoved the deflated airbag out of the way. By the time I finished, the driver was awake, reaching up to me with one trembling arm. The horror of the situation seized me suddenly, squeezing the air from my lungs, the life from my heart. Dad, dead, Darla, hurt. Why had the DWBs followed me? Why couldn't they have let me slip away, let me take my family back to Warren to struggle together to survive, or at least to die united? I had no answers, just pure rage. I knelt before the bandit, pulled the butcher knife off my belt, and lifted it high over my head. Someone caught my arm from behind. I turned. Alyssa was there, shouting something at me. I saw her mouth working soundlessly. I twisted my knife hand free and brought the blade slashing down toward the driver's throat. Alyssa caught my arm again. She put her face inches from mine and shook her head. The rage washed out of me as quickly as it had come. I again twisted free of her grasp and threw the knife. Powered by my disgust and grief, it flew clear across the snowbank on the far side of the road. Alyssa wrapped her arms around me, and suddenly I was sobbing. I clung to her and cried until the back of her coat was wet with my tears. The sewer stench of death brought me back to my senses. The bandit's arm was down, and the unburnt right side of his face had relaxed into a facsimile of peace. I lifted my eyes past him. Tears still clouded my vision. All I could see was a blurry gray, the ashen smear of my father's remains upon the eternal snow. Chapter 83. Let's get out of here, I said. It was weird not being able to hear myself. I could tell I was talking only by the vibrations in my mouth and nose. Alyssa nodded. She started to turn away. I caught her arm and gestured at the truck. "You drive?" I asked. She shook her head and said something I couldn't understand. I sagged against her. I could barely walk, and now I'd have to drive. Alyssa slid into the truck and I followed, stopping behind the wheel. The truck was an automatic. The keys were dangling from the ignition, and the fuel gauge read just shy of full. I slid the gear selector into reverse and eased my foot onto the gas. We lurched free of the snowbank with a bounce. I backed the truck around the body of its former driver. The fire amid the wreck had died down to a dull, angry glow. I cranked the wheel over and inched past, staying as close to the berm as I could. I pulled up beside Mom and Ben. Neither of them made any move to get in. Darla was still curled against the ragged brick wall. Alyssa and I got out. I ran to Darla. She was conscious but dazed. I helped her into the front seat of the truck, buckling her into the middle, where she'd be next to me. I turned back toward Mom. "Can you drive?" I asked. Her eyes were focused on a world apart from this one. Maybe her hearing was damaged, too. "Mom!" I shouted. Her lips were still. She stared past the dying glow of the wreck. I took Mom's hand. I led her like a child into the passenger seat of the pickup and buckled the seatbelt around her. When I slipped back out of the truck, I saw Alyssa brushing Ben, trying to coax him into motion. "We've got to go," I told Alyssa. She nodded at me and led Ben towards the truck. They slid into the back seat. I put the truck in drive and headed north, away from Iowa City and the DWB slavers, toward Warren and the safety of Uncle Paul's farm. The windshield was cracked so badly it was tough to see through it. I had to bend my body and crane my neck to peer through a patch of clear glass. I found a map in the glove compartment and handed it to Alyssa. Darla had passed out again, and Mom was awake, but in another world. Alyssa charted a course that skirted around Anamosa and its prison. Each time we reached an intersection, she would point the right direction and yell. I still couldn't make out words, but at least I could hear that she was saying something now. My ears started buzzing with a high-pitched whine. I took that as a good sign, even though it was incredibly annoying. I was constantly dizzy, worried I'd accidentally drive into a snow berm. About 20 miles out of Iowa City, I got so nauseated that I had to pull over and vomit on the icy road. My eyelids were drooping. Mom, Darla, and Ben were completely zoned out. I fought to stay awake, biting my lip, slapping my face, and pinching my legs. The cold air rushing through the broken side windows helped some, but I didn't think I could keep going long enough to get to Warren. And Darla needed help, soon. I wanted nothing more than to stop, curl up, and cry. To mourn my father. To try to help Darla with her infection, and my mother with her grief. But I had to go on. The frozen roads of Iowa were no safe place for funerals or remembrances. I pointed to Worthington on Alyssa's map. "Go there." She nodded. "I don't know if it'll still be there, because the Peckerwoods and Cascade were planning to attack. Hope the walls held." Alyssa nodded and said something I couldn't hear. By the time we reached Worthington, it was late afternoon. We approached from the west on 272nd Street. There was no gate on this side, just a sheer ice wall towering above the road, blocking it completely. I could make out figures running atop the wall, so I stopped the truck well out of rifle range. I looked over my shoulder. Mom and Ben were wide awake but dazed. "I can't go talk to them," I said to Alyssa. She shrugged. "My ears, they're still not working. You'll have to go do it. If they look like Peckerwoods, run. If they're farmers, tell them you're with Alex Halperin and that we've got Darla Edmonds with us and she's hurt. Tell them I've still got kale seeds to trade. Ask for the librarian, Rita May. She'll help." "Okay," Alyssa yelled into my ear. I was amazed I could sort of hear her in an echoey way. Alyssa tumbled out the rear door. She trudged towards Worthington, her hands up and palms out. There were 9 or 10 people on the wall now. I hoped they were farmers, citizens of Worthington, but I couldn't tell from this distance. All of them aimed guns at her. A lump of guilt lodged in my throat. I should be the one walking out there alone. But since I couldn't hear any commands, I might get myself shot. And surely Alyssa would seem to be less of a threat by herself. There was one thing I could do. If something went wrong, I could drive up and get her. I put my hands back on the steering wheel, put the truck into gear, and rested my foot on the brake. Then there was nothing to do but wait. Alyssa stopped a few hundred feet from the wall and stood there a long time. When she finally started back, she moved at a far brisker pace than she had on the way in. When she reached us, I couldn't contain my impatience. "Did Worthington hold out? Did you talk to Rita May? Will they let us in?" With a combination of shouted words and gestures, Alyssa told me that yes, Worthington had beaten back the Peckerwoods' attack, and they would let us in. Apparently there was a road around Worthington adjacent to the wall that we could follow to reach the town's only gate. I inched forward under the guns of Worthington's defenders. The road along the wall turned out to be more of a track of packed snow than an actual road. Still, the four-wheel drive dually handled it with ease. The DWBs were murderous cannibals, but they sure had good taste in pickups. At the gate, we had to surrender our guns. I still had the assault rifle Dad had taken from Chad, and the gun mounted on the roof turned out to be another assault rifle. I hadn't thought to check earlier. I pulled the truck up in front of the low metal building that housed the fire station, city hall, and library. Mayor Kenda came out to meet us before I'd even stepped from the truck. She yelled something at me, but I couldn't make out the words. I pointed at my ears. She said something else, and Alyssa shot me a worried look. "Is Rita May around?" I asked. Mayor Kenda said something else, and Alyssa answered her. I'd had enough of being outside the loop of this conversation. I knew Mayor Kenda meant well, but she might decide the best thing for us would be to take our truck and keep us here in Worthington, where we'd be safe. I strode directly to the library door and jerked it open. Rita May was at her desk, reading by the light of an oil lamp. She had one hand on the shotgun propped against a bookcase, but when she saw me, her face broke into a huge grin. She let go of the shotgun and darted around her desk. She hugged me surprisingly hard for such a tiny old lady, and I struggled not to collapse and pull us both off our feet. When Rita May broke the embrace, she started talking to me. I could make out a word here or there, but not enough to follow what she was saying. I pointed at my ears and pantomimed an explosion. Rita May got it right away. She took a stubby library pencil and a sheet of paper that looked like it was the flyleaf from a book off her desk. "I was afraid I wouldn't see you again," she wrote. "Darla's gunshot wound is bad," I said. "We need help." I swayed on my feet and grabbed the edge of her desk for support. "Paramedics in the fire station," Rita May wrote. She tucked the paper and pencil into her pocket, grabbed my arm, and led me out of the library. I tried to veer toward the pickup where Darla was, but Rita May pulled me to the pedestrian door of the fire station. Inside, the station was sparsely illuminated by a small fire smoldering on the concrete floor. A man in a worn paramedic uniform sat on a metal folding chair beside the fire. Rita May said something, and he sprang to his feet, rushing past us toward the pickup. A small hole had been cut high up on a nearby wall to let out the smoke. A row of cots lay to the left of the fire. On the right, there was another room created with makeshift curtains. More metal folding chairs were scattered randomly throughout both rooms. There wasn't a fire truck in the station. When I'd been here last year, it had been stuck in the ash outside. Obviously, it had been moved, but not back into its garage. The paramedic returned, carrying Darla in his arms. He ushered me into the curtained area, and Rita May followed us. Inside, there was a vinyl exam couch, 2 rolling chairs, and a stainless steel table with cabinets under it. The paramedic examined Darla efficiently, inspecting the wound in her shoulder and taking her temperature, blood pressure, and pulse. Can you treat the infection? I asked. The paramedic said something I couldn't make out. Rita Mae whipped out her paper and pencil and wrote out his words for me. I'm not supposed to have to treat everything. I just stabilize them and drive them to Mercy Medical in Dyersville. That's the way it's supposed to work. She needs antibiotics, right? Yes, and a doctor to clean and debride that wound. So what do we do? I asked. Nothing, the paramedic replied. His voice was so loud and anguished that I could understand it even without Rita Mae's written translation. Nothing? I yelled. At least give her some antibiotics. Can't. They're rationed. Mayor Kenda keeps them locked up. I stepped away from the paramedic and slammed my palm into the corrugated metal wall. The pain got me thinking again. I dug around in my jacket and pulled out the last 11 packets of kale seeds. I want a 10-day course of antibiotics and a week's worth of food for 5 people. It suddenly occurred to me that kale seeds might not be as valuable now. Presumably, Worthington would be growing the ones I traded to them right after Darla was shot. I dug deeper in my pocket, pulled out one of my carefully hoarded bags of wheat, and handed it to Rita Mae with all the kale seeds. I can get a lot more than that if you give me some time to negotiate, Rita Mae wrote. I don't care. We're leaving Worthington in 15 minutes. I'm taking Darla to Dr. McCarthy in Warren. You're falling down on your feet. You leave now, you'll wreck your truck. I started to yell that I didn't care, but bit back my words. She had a point. Crashing on the way to Warren wouldn't get Darla the help she needed. You're right, I said quietly. We should get Darla started on her antibiotics, get something to eat, and sleep a few hours. The paramedic said something to Rita Mae. Floyd says he's got extra blankets, Rita Mae wrote. You can all stay here if you like. I'll be back with the medicine and food. Floyd had laid a heavy blanket over Darla. As I turned to get everyone else settled, I saw Darla staring at me from the exam table. Her eyes reflected the light, shining like distant campfires on an icy winter night. I stepped toward her. I wanted, needed, to talk to her about what had happened, to learn how she'd survived. But by the time I reached her side, she was asleep again. I pulled up a chair to sit in vigil over her, as if my will alone could keep her alive. Chapter 84. Rita Mae returned in less than an hour, carrying a backpack stuffed with food and drugs. Floyd woke Darla up, gave her a glass of water, 2 Tylenol, and a Cipro tablet. I held her hand for no more than a minute before she fell back asleep. Everyone else bedded down on the cots, close to the small fire. I dragged my blankets into Darla's room and wrapped them around myself, sitting on the chair by her bed. Soon I was asleep. Darla haunted my dreams. She was naked and curled into a ball, alone in a vast white space. She curled up tighter and tighter, and her skin turned red and blistered as if from sunburn. I screamed, "Darla!" but she couldn't hear me. I ran toward her, but she receded faster than I could run. Purple and green and yellow blotches crawled across her skin, and she hunkered down even further into an impossibly small ball. Suddenly her skin was black and charring, and then there were flames. Darla was burning before my eyes. The flames jumped and lit Mom, who was somehow beside her, and they jumped again and burned Dad, everything charred to ash. Alyssa crawled toward me, blocking the cinders of my family from view. She was naked and above me, her breasts swaying pendulously, hypnotically. I was excited and ashamed. She called to me seductively, "Alex," and I lifted my head toward her. I woke up. "Alex, Alex." Alyssa was above me, fully clothed, and she was shaking my shoulder and yelling my name, although it was in no way seductive. And I could hear, not well maybe, but well enough to understand her. "Yeah," I mumbled. "You said you wanted to leave in 4 hours," she said. "It's time." "Thanks," I said. Alyssa left, and I stood, turning toward Darla. "You okay?" I asked as her eyes opened. "Shoulder hurts," she said. "I'll live. How about you?" "I'm okay. now that I found you. Suddenly I recalled what finding her had cost. My dad slamming the shifter into reverse. I choked back a sob. Darla reached out with her good hand, drawing me down into an embrace, and I bawled into the comforting semicircle of her arm. "Shh," she said. When my tears subsided, I whispered, "Things are never going to be the same again, are they?" "What do you mean?" I thought that finding my parents would change things, would, well, I knew things wouldn't go back to the way they were before the volcano, but I thought they'd get better. Get better how? I guess I thought I wouldn't have to carry everything on my own shoulders, every decision. I don't always know what's right. Sometimes I think it'd be nice to be a little kid again, to leave the weightiest decisions to my parents. "Alex," Darla said, her face serious, "you haven't been a kid for a long time now. And now I never will be again." "No." I was afraid I'd start bawling again, so I changed the subject. I was afraid they'd flens you, or... Danny didn't want to flens me. He thought I was cute. Darla's face twisted with disgust. He was going to let me heal and then take me to bed. Rape you. I held the rail of her cot in one hand, gripping it so hard I wondered if it might crumple in my fist. "Yeah, but Alyssa went missing, and he had to send a girl to the Dirty White Boys as her replacement. I was handy." I sat down, rested my head against her shoulder, and listened. "The truck broke down on the way. Radiator problem. I told him how to fix it. So when I got to Iowa City, I wound up repairing stuff for them instead of filling a bed in their whorehouse. Thank God." "Yeah," I replied, as gently as I could manage. "You had a lockpick and a weapon. Why were you still there?" "Look at me. I'm weak and sick. I wouldn't eat the meat the DWBs offered me, so I never got enough food to get stronger. And I've never found the right moment to use my lockpick and shank until you showed up." "The important thing is that you survived," I said. "Nothing else matters to me." "Well, it matters to me," Darla snapped. An overwhelming gratitude flooded me. I'd been insanely lucky to find her amid the chaos of Iowa. Words failed me, and I hugged her gently instead. Then she pushed me back out to arm's length. "I've seen the way Alyssa looks at you." I rescued her and Ben. At first, I thought she was you. There's more than gratitude in her eyes. "Yeah," she tried to... "I knew it. I swear to God I'll shank that bitch." "Darla, no, it's okay." She found a way to protect herself and her brother when she was with the Peckerwoods, and she's still falling back on that, using sex to survive. "It's wrong. Give her a break. What's wrong is that she felt she had to, that she had no other options." "I don't trust her." "You don't have to trust her. You can trust me." Darla stared into my eyes for a pregnant moment and then pulled me back into a hug. "I saved this for you," I said, pulling away from her embrace. I extracted the broken chain from my pocket. Darla's eyes shone as she fished the 15/16 nut I'd given her out of her own pocket. "It was stuck in the layers of my shirts. I fiddled with it when things were bad. It helped." I threaded the knot onto my broken chain and knotted it behind Darla's neck. "We should get moving." 15 minutes later, we were rolling away from Worthington. Rita May had gotten everything I wanted, although she scolded me about not giving her enough time to negotiate properly. She'd also spent part of the night taping plastic over the broken windows of our truck. I hoped I'd see her again. She was one of the few people I trusted. Mom offered to drive, which I took as a good sign that she might be emerging from her daze. But her hands trembled and her voice quavered, so I told her no. She didn't argue, which struck me as a strange role reversal. The black night faded to gray and then to a separated yellow as we drove. With the increased visibility, I punched our speed up to about 40. The roads were too uneven and slick to go any faster. The fuel gauge read 3/4. I thought that would be enough to reach Warren. Maybe. If we didn't wreck or have to take a massive detour on the way. Alyssa navigated. We avoided all the big towns and as many of the small burgs as we could. The few we did pass through were burned and abandoned. When she wasn't busy plotting our route, Alyssa brushed Ben. He didn't seem to need it. Given everything we'd been through, he was holding up remarkably well. Maybe she was brushing him to comfort herself. I didn't want to cross the Mississippi on any bridge. I assumed they'd all be watched, either by Blacklake or one of the gangs. Nor did I want to get anywhere near Lock Number 12 and the barges of wheat Blacklake defended. Instead, we found a boat ramp between the lock and Cibola, Iowa, and I used it to drive out onto the frozen expanse of the Mississippi. On the far side of the river, I pulled the truck into a cove where we were sheltered by trees. We ate a breakfast of cold cornmeal mush, beef jerky, and dandelion leaves. I didn't leave the truck running, but the warmth from the heater lingered long enough to keep us fairly comfortable during breakfast. As we ate, I sat sideways in my seat, watching Darla. Her face was more angular, her cheeks concave with hunger and illness. But she was here, beside me. The miracle of it left me breathless. I stretched out a hand to hold hers. After breakfast, I asked, "Can I check your fever?" I placed the back of my hand against Darla's forehead. "I'm okay," she said. "I think the Tylenol's working." I thought her forehead still felt hot, and she was slumped against the seat. "We should go." I started the truck and pulled out of the cove. It took more than an hour to find a way off the ice of the Mississippi. We moved slowly in Illinois, picking our way through the backroads, trying to avoid both Galena, where there was a Blacklake camp, and Stockton, where all the roads were blocked by their crazy wall of cars. It took us almost 2 hours to travel the last 30 miles to Warren. We approached my uncle's farm from the north, the same way Darla and I had arrived last year. I let my speed pick up a little bit in anticipation. Evidently, there'd been a lot of traffic recently. When we left, there had been a few inches of unplowed snow on Canyon Park Road. Now, it was packed solid. I cruised up the last rise before the farm. But when I saw it, I slammed on the brakes, fishtailing to a shivering stop. The farm was gone. In its place, there was an enormous, ramshackle tent city, swarming with people. Chapter 85. I slammed the shifter into reverse and backed down the hill, out of sight from the farm. "What are you doing?" Mom yelled. "Getting out of here." I cranked the wheel over so fast the truck slid into a 180. "That's your uncle's farm. Rebecca's down there." "We don't know who all those people are." I shifted into drive and accelerated down the road, away from the farm. "What if they're another Flenser gang?" "Then we need to get in there right now," Mom screeched, "to check on Rebecca." "We'll figure out what's going on and find Rebecca, but I'm not going to rush in there and risk getting us killed." "You have another route in mind, Lieutenant?" Ben asked. "Park in Apple River Canyon and come in on foot through the forest. Scout it and see what's going on," I said. "What do you think?" "That is a sound plan." 15 minutes later, we were inside Apple River Canyon State Park, which backed directly against Uncle Paul's farm. I pulled the truck to the side of the road. "I'll hike to the backside of the farm, see what's going on, and come back. 2 hours, tops." "I'm going with you," Darla said. She struggled to lift herself out of the seat. "No, you need to rest." "Somebody needs to go with you. What if you run into trouble?" "I'm going," Mom said. I leaned over to kiss Darla, and Alyssa suddenly became fascinated with something in the backseat footwell. I opened my door, and Mom and I left. Slogging through the deep snow was hard work. I broke the trail, working my way through the leafless forest to approach the farm from the west. Before we were close enough to see anything, I heard the rhythmic thwacks of several axes in use. We slowed our pace, moving from tree to tree until we were close enough to see. A party of about a dozen men and women were felling and stripping trees. Most of them had rifles slung across their backs. 5 logs were laid out in the snow already.
"Isn't that Stew from Warren?" I whispered to Mom.
"I don't recognize him," she whispered back.
Just then, one of the men lowered his axe and turned our way.
"Paul!"
Mom yelled. She started pushing through the snow toward him. Still, I hesitated a second, trying to make sure.
"Janice!"
Uncle Paul dropped his axe and rushed toward us. The rest of the woodcutting party put aside their axes and unslung their rifles, eyeing me and Mom warily. Mom embraced Uncle Paul, and for a while there were just joyful tears of reunion.
"You found them," Uncle Paul said to me at last. "And my brother, did he..."
"Dad," I said, he didn't make it." Uncle Paul's face passed through 2 quick transformations. His Adam's apple bobbed twice and his face broke and sagged. Then he bit his lower lip and his face reformed as if he were delaying his grief through pure force of will. He turned to the rest of the group of woodcutters and shouted,
"It's okay. My nephew and sister-in-law are home."
They slung their guns and picked up their axes again. "You have any food?" Uncle Paul asked.
"Yeah," I said, "enough for the 5 of us for a week or so."
5 of you? Darla and 2 people I met on the road. Alyssa and Ben. I promised they could stay with us.
Huh. Might not want to. Never mind. Keep the food a secret.
Okay. That reminds me. I reached into my jacket pocket and pulled out my last carefully hoarded bag and passed it to Uncle Paul.
Wheat.
Uncle Paul stowed the bag under his coat, shaking his head in admiration. Bag could save all our lives.
Our truck's in the park. I've got to get back. Take Darla to Dr. McCarthy and Warren. She's hurt.
Warren, Uncle Paul said. Dr. McCarthy is here. All of Warren is. Everybody who's left, anyway.
What?
Slimeball's running stalked and attacked Warren a few days after you left. Took it over. Threw everybody out of town. That's why they're all here.
Why?
Out of food. Wanted Warren's store of pork and kale, I guess.
Bastards, I said. Like we don't have enough to deal with?
Uncle Paul nodded grimly. I'll take your mother up to the house and let everyone know you're coming. I hugged him and turned away, trudging back through the dead forest. I returned to the truck, filled everyone else in, and drove back to the front side of the farm on Canyon Park Road. When I got closer to it, I could see that Tent City was too generous a description of the chaotic settlement that had engulfed Uncle Paul's farm. Sure, there were tents. There were also crude wooden shacks, igloos, lean-tos crafted from tree branches, and structures that appeared to be made of plastic scraps and twigs. People were moving everywhere, and hundreds of small fires burned within the camp. 30 or 40 people were working to build something new. They erected a wall, about a dozen stout logs lashed together with their bases buried and the tops sharpened. If they planned to encircle the whole camp, they had a lot of work ahead of them. We couldn't get very close to the house. All the makeshift shelters blocked the driveway. I parked at the edge of the road and grabbed the backpack with the food, slinging it over my shoulder. I carried one of the assault rifles and handed the other one to Darla. As we set out for the house, Darla stumbled. She handed her rifle to Alyssa.
"I don't know how to use one of these," Alyssa protested.
"Just carry it," Darla snapped, "and fake it."
Instead, Alyssa handed the assault rifle to Ben and helped Darla thread her way through the camp, supporting her with a hand under her shoulder. The house still stank of goat, which surprised me. Surely if there wasn't enough food, they would have slaughtered all the goats. But then I heard a bleat from the direction of the guest room and realized that Uncle Paul was protecting a few. Maybe he was planning to breed them. There was also an unclean stink, like rotting flesh and feces. When I stepped through the small entryway to the living room, I saw why. All the living room furniture was gone, replaced with a dozen crude pallets packed into the limited floor space. A fire roared in the hearth.
The room was crowded with the sick and the dying. Some had blood-stained bandages on their torsos. One was missing most of his arm. Others just looked sweaty and feverish. It was horrible. I couldn't bring Darla in here. Dr. McCarthy and Belinda were both there, working together to roll a patient over. "Dr. McCarthy," I said. "Good to see you, Alex. Give me a sec." Dr. McCarthy finished rolling the patient, and Belinda started cleaning his backside with a sponge. Dr. McCarthy stood. "You look like hell." "I'm okay. Darla's sick," I said. "What's wrong?" "Bullet wound in my shoulder," Darla said. "It's infected."
"Come into the kitchen," Dr. McCarthy replied.
The kitchen table had been draped with a sheet and pressed into service as an exam table. Alyssa tried to help Darla onto the table, but Darla pushed her hand away and levered herself up. Alyssa shrugged it off.
"All the rest of you, clear out," Dr. McCarthy said.
Darla seized my hand, holding me there as Alyssa and Ben left. "He stays," she said.
Dr. McCarthy shrugged. "You could help hold her. I've got to clean and debride that wound and check to see if the bullet's still in there. You remember what that's like?"
I nodded, my thoughts as grim as the look on Darla's face. Dr. McCarthy passed Darla the familiar leather-wrapped stick. When he started working on Darla's shoulder, her face turned vivid red, and she started sweating despite the cold air. She gripped my hand so hard I could feel my bones grinding together. When he started cutting away the dead flesh around her wound, she screamed around the stick and tried to launch herself off the table. I fell across her, pinning her arms down. Finally, mercifully, Darla passed out. I collapsed into a chair as Dr. McCarthy finished treating her shoulder. He didn't sew up the wound, just painted it with antiseptic and affixed a bandage over it. I was relieved not to have to help. My head swam in a way that suggested that I might be following Darla to La La Land shortly. I stumbled to my feet and stepped out the back door in search of fresh air.
Chapter 86. Dr. McCarthy followed me outside. "You okay?"
I was kneeling in the snow, head in my hands. I should never have stood up on that overpass. Should never have gone looking for my parents. None of this would have happened if we just stayed put. He placed his hand on my shoulder.
"Terrible things happen to good people, Alex. They did before Yellowstone blew, and it's even more true now. Hiding out at the farm wouldn't have protected you or Darla from that."
I shook my head, and Dr. McCarthy extended a hand to help me up.
"You going to the meeting?"
"Meeting?
Mayor's addressing all the able-bodied adults in camp tonight."
"Guess I'm going, then."
"You should."
When Darla woke up, Alyssa and I helped her upstairs and got her settled in one of the bedrooms. It was bitterly cold up there, but at least Darla wouldn't have to sleep with the crowded stench in the living room. As we came out, Mom and Uncle Paul came up the stairs with Rebecca, Cousin Max, and Cousin Anna in tow. We had a little party of hugs and smiles right there in the hallway. For a moment, I was able to forget the horrors of Iowa. The moment passed quickly. They looked tired and wan. After the joy of our reunion had passed, I saw something else in their faces. Fear. "Rebecca, I'm sorry," I whispered. "About Dad." She scowled at me for a moment before her face melted and she started sobbing. I pulled her into a hug. I started trying to explain.
I know, she choked out the words between her sobs. "Mom told me how he saved your lives."
We held each other like that for a bit while everyone else shuffled uncomfortably around us. Eventually I tried changing the subject. "You going to the meeting tonight?"
"No."
She broke the hug, folded her arms and scowled.
"They say I'm not an adult."
"That's crazy. At 14, you're old enough to walk and chew bubblegum at the same time. Of course you're an adult."
Rebecca punched my arm hard enough to hurt. She'd gotten a lot stronger.
"Seriously, would you do me a huge favor? Keep an eye on Darla while I'm gone at the meeting. You get to go. That's so not fair.
I know. Look, Darla's sick. Just make sure she stays in bed and rests and gets her water and food if she'll eat.
There isn't any food, Alex.
How could I explain to my little sister that I had brought food and fully intended to make sure that Darla ate even if everyone else in the camp starved? Never mind the food.
What's wrong with her?
She got shot. The wound's infected. Got plenty of that around here.
Yeah, I'll watch her.
Thanks. Love you, sis. I kissed her on the forehead and left. Uncle Paul, Aunt Carolyn, Mom, Alyssa, Ben, and I went to the meeting together. A huge bonfire had been lit between the edge of the camp and the woods. Everyone crowded in close enough to absorb the heat radiating from the fire. The mayor of Warren, Bob Petty, stepped even closer so that the fire illuminated his face as he spoke. Soon he was sweating, and the orange light glinting from his wet face gave him a demonic look. His speech was long and convoluted, but basically it boiled down to this. Since Stockton invaded Warren, the mayor had assigned scouts to keep watch and look for an opportunity to fight back. Stockton had only moved a small amount of pork and kale out of Warren in the week they'd held it. But earlier today, 11 trucks had pulled into Warren. They were being loaded with pork, kale, and cornmeal, the food the people of Warren needed to survive. The mayor had decided that instead of waiting to starve on the farm, every able-bodied person with a weapon would try to retake Warren. He ended his speech with a bunch of meaningless rah-rah stuff and instructions to be ready at dawn. When the applause and scattered cheers died down, Ben spoke into the silence. "That is a stupid plan," he said in a loud voice. A few people booed, but Ben went on. "It does not make sense to attack where the enemy is expecting it or when he expects it. A better alternative..." Ben kept talking, but the mayor shouted over him. "You're not from Warren, son, and I don't recall asking for your opinion. It's decided." The crowd broke out into a babble of conversation. I sucked in a deep breath and bellowed, "He's right! It's like sparring. You never strike where your opponent expects you to." The mayor glared at me. "And what would you suggest?" His voice practically dripped with derision. "Attack Stockton," I said. "All their fighters will be in Warren. They won't be expecting it." "Our food is in Warren, not Stockton," someone yelled. "Their homes, wives, and children are in Stockton," I replied. "Once we control it, we can negotiate." "We're not going to negotiate with the aggressors," the mayor yelled. "Tomorrow, we're going to Warren to get our food back. This meeting is adjourned. Get a good night's sleep. We leave at dawn."
Dispirited, I turned away from the fire. We trudged back to the house in silence, except for Ben, who talked nonstop about famous military attacks that had failed because they were too predictable. Uncle Paul got an oil lamp off a hook in the entryway and lit it using a stick from the hearth in the living room Coombe Hospital. Upstairs, I paused at the door to the girls' room. I wanted to talk to Darla, but didn't want to wake her. I heard voices through the door and knocked. "Come in," Rebecca called. It was pitch black inside. The light from Uncle Paul's lamp receded down the hallway. "You guys made a place for Alyssa to sleep?" I asked. "Yeah," Rebecca said. "Let me get some light." I heard a thump thump, and then Rebecca pushed past me, carrying a tiny oil lamp, like they used to put on tables at fancy restaurants. She lit it from Uncle Paul's lamp and returned to the bedroom. Since when had she gotten so efficient? Amazing what a volcanic eruption can do to change a pesky little sister into an ally. There were two beds in the small bedroom and two places to sleep on the floor, made up with extra blankets and pillows. Darla was snuggled into the far bed. Her face looked wan, but more peaceful than I'd seen it since we'd rescued her. "You okay?" I asked her. She shrugged at me and told Rebecca and Anna, "I want to talk to Alex for a minute. Alone, okay?" "Sure," Rebecca said. "Yell when you're done." Anna got out of her bed. She was fully clothed. They all were. It was freezing in that room. They went into the hall, and I closed the door and sat beside Darla's bed. "You seem better," I said. Maybe a little.
That's good. We lapsed into silence for a moment. Can I get you anything? I asked. She reached out and grabbed my hand. Dr. McCarthy says you might blame yourself for what happened to me. I should never have stood up on that overpass. Never have dragged you back to Iowa with me.
You didn't drag anyone. I insisted on going.
But nothing, Alex. Maybe standing up on that overpass was a mistake. Maybe not. But you came for me. You found me and saved me.
She crushed my hand in hers.
I always will, I whispered.
I know.
Tomorrow, I'm going to help with the attack on Warren. It's a stupid attack, at least that's what Ben thinks, and he's probably the smartest guy here. But whatever happens, I'm going to find a way to survive and come back to you. Because I love you, and I always will.
Darla's eyes brimmed with tears. I love you too, Alex.
Her words fell on me like rain in a desert, bringing the promise of a glorious field of new blossoms. We'll make a place for ourselves in this shitty world somehow. We'll find a way to make the life we want, to get married and have a family. I swear we will.
Darla reached out, pulling me down onto the bed alongside her. My father was dead, my mother crushed with grief. I couldn't surrender my burdens, the life or death decisions that we had to make on an almost daily basis in this new world. But together, Darla and I would carry them. As we embraced, my spirit soared. I was seized by a fierce joy. I would survive. I would survive and do battle at Darla's side. We would fight together to make a place in this disaster-hewn world, a place where we could live in peace.
Or die trying. Author's note. The severity of the volcanic winter that would follow a supervolcano eruption is the subject of considerable debate in the scientific community. The most commonly held view is that a volcanic winter would lower the average global temperature by 5 to 9 degrees Fahrenheit for a period of 6 to 10 years. Other scientists believe the temperature change would be much less drastic, on the order of 2 degrees Fahrenheit. Yet another hypothesis, the controversial Toba catastrophe theory, holds that such an eruption could trigger a volcanic winter so severe that it would lead to an ice age. As a novelist, I've chosen to depict the more severe and dramatic possibility. Acknowledgements. The process of creating Ashen Winter led me to a host of subjects that I know nothing about. I'm indebted to the following people for their technical help. Any errors that remain are probably the result of my bullheaded refusal to take their good advice. Carol Oates, Linda Poitvin, Nick Lewaz, Jill Robinson, and Zach Robinson for patiently answering my questions about autism and for suggesting numerous changes to Ashen Winter. I couldn't have brought Ben to life without you. Joseph E. Bowling for training me with his extensive collection of pistols and shotguns. Terry Farley for teaching me the rudiments of operating an M4 carbine, an Uzi submachine gun, and a Remington 300 sniper rifle. Fred Ropke of the Ropke Armor Museum for allowing me to crawl all over and under his beautifully restored M35A2 and for loaning me its operation and repair manuals. Helen Louise Bowling and Josh Mugel for their help on medical questions. Ray Lewaz for his pharmaceutical expertise. Ken Bandy for training me on shortwave radio operation and his wife Carol for putting up with me while I kept asking just one more question an hour after dinner was on the table. Aubrey Wesson for advice on the properties of propane, natural gas, and BLEVE explosions. Thanks to my critique group, the YA Cannibals. Shannon Alexander, Lisa Phipps, Robert Kent, Jody Spark, and Virginia Vaught for making Ashen Winter take months longer to write than I anticipated. The extra time was worth it. Thanks to Karen Brissett and Katarina Senft for their cheerleading of Ashfall and helpful comments on the Ashen Winter manuscript. Thanks to everyone associated with Tanglewood Press and Publishers Group West for making my first publishing experience a wonderful one. I particularly appreciate Rebecca Gross for her superbly well-organized book tours and Aaron Blacketer for making my life easier. Above all, thank you to Peggy Tierney. She never loses sight of why we do this, for our readers. On that note, thanks to all my readers. Your enthusiasm buoys me when I begin to sink into the dark water of self-doubt. Thank you to all the booksellers, librarians, and teachers who've helped Ashfall connect with its readership. I dedicated Ash and Winter to my mother, partly in your honor. She was a teacher before I was born, a librarian while I grew up, and is now a bookseller. Thank you to the people of Iowa and Northwest Illinois who've been so welcoming during my 3 research trips to the area. I'll be back soon. And most of all, as always, thank you, Margaret, my wife, first reader, best friend, and true love. About the author. Mike Mullen's first job was scraping the gum off the undersides of desks at his high school. From there, things went steadily downhill. He almost got fired by the owner of a bookstore due to his poor taste in earrings. He worked at a place that showed slides of poopy diapers during lunch. It did cut down on the cafeteria budget. The hazing process at the next company included eating live termites raised by the resident entomologist, so that didn't last long either. For a while, Mike juggled bottles at a wine shop, sometimes to disastrous effect. Oh, and then there was the job where swarms of wasps occasionally tried to chase him off ladders. So he's really glad this writing thing seems to be working out. Mike holds a black belt in Sangam Taekwondo. He lives in Indianapolis with his wife and her 3 cats. Ash and Winter is his second novel. His debut, Ashfall, was named one of the top 5 young adult novels of 2011 by National Public Radio, a best teen book of 2011 by Kirkus Reviews, and a New Voices selection by the American Booksellers Association. Connect with Mike at www.mikemullenauthor.com. This has been Ash and Winter by Mike Mullen. If you enjoyed this book, please look for the continuation, Sunrise, also by Mike Mullen. Other books by Mike Mullen include Ashfall and Surface Tension. The end.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.